My first sustained encounter with Calvin Coolidge came by way of William Allen White's 1938 book, A Puritan in Babylon, the most delightfully titled biography I have ever read and most probably will ever read. White was editor of the Emporia Gazette in Emporia, Kansas. And though he ran a local paper in a small community, his political influence was national in scope and was as potent as it was legendary. A son of the heartland, he was a proponent for an internationalist worldview in a Republican Party that was still heavily populated by Midwestern isolationists. But most of all, he was a storyteller, adept at sharing a breaking news item, drawing one into a narrative of diplomatic imperative, or recounting the life of a New Englander who found himself in the White House. That New Englander, that Puritan, was Coolidge. And the Babylon in which he found himself was the Washington of Warren G. Harding and the Teapot Dome scandal, and the America of the Great Gatsby and the Black Sox. I enjoyed reading White's biography 20 years ago. Done with it, I shelved it with my other American history books. I didn't think much about White's book or Mr. Coolidge, to be honest, until earlier this year. That's when I attended a fascinating presentation at the Hanover Inn by Amity Schlaes, the author of a new biography of our 32nd president, titled with a simplicity and terseness of which the man himself would heartily approve, Coolidge. The publication of Professor Schlaes' book was well-timed. For you see, Silent Cal is enjoying something of a boom these days. Long admired within conservative circles, he was among Ronald Reagan's favorite presidents. He's been drawing the attention of scholars in recent years. For decades, seen as a dour figure rooted in the past, Coolidge's successful stewardship of the nation during a time of immense, even dizzying, social, political, and technological development has been drawing renewed interest during our own turbulent era of change. Now, some of you might be thinking, this is all very interesting, or alternatively, as dull as watching paint dry, but I don't come to church to hear history lessons about political figures. And to you, I reply, rightly so, which is why I ask you to bear with me. After the lecture, there was a book signing. It was then that I met Professor Schlaes, who asked me what I did. And I told her that I was the pastor here, and her eyes opened wide. I'm not sure, she said, but I believe Coolidge's church, First Congregational in Washington, may have been integrated. Now, we spent a few moments talking about the significance of this possibility, and I then moved on to someone else so someone else would have a chance to speak with her. I realized that evening that I'd never given much consideration to Calvin Coolidge's religious life beyond the most likely apocryphal story about a Sunday on which Mrs. Coolidge had been unable to attend the service with her husband. Supposedly, she asked what the sermon had been about. Sin, he replied. Well, what did Dr. Pierce say about it, she wondered. He said he was against it, Coolidge is said to have explained in his typically terse manner. Once, though, presented with the prospect that he had belonged to an integrated church in what was still a very southern, segregated city, I was curious and I was intrigued. And what I soon learned was impressive and inspiring. Calvin Coolidge took his faith seriously, not as a politician seeking to sway demographic groups, not as a national figure wishing to shape his public persona, but as a Christian who tried as best he could to live what he confessed. He didn't attend prayer breakfast, nor did he cultivate relationships with the nation's most prominent Protestant clergy. He most certainly did not bang on publicly about what Jesus would have him do. But he executed the duties of his office as a man who took seriously the gospel. Now, Calvin Coolidge was one of four presidents whose professed religious faith can be associated with our denomination, the United Church of Christ, or its forebear, the Congregational Church. The first was John Adams. And the second, Adams' son John Quincy, whose post-presidential career with its heroic and inspiring battle against slavery is deserving of a sermon of its own. However, to be fair, it should be noted that though both began life as Trinitarians, they harbored Unitarian sympathies later in life. The third president on the list is the present incumbent, Barack Obama, who for many years was a member of Trinity United Church of Christ in Chicago. However, as a candidate, Obama resigned his membership in Trinity in the wake of the controversy stemming from his pastor's teaching and preaching, and has yet to formally join a new congregation. So, they have asterisks. But caveats aside, we'll claim all three of them in addition to Coolidge. After all, we have a bit of work to do if we're ever to catch up with the Presbyterians, 8, let alone the Episcopalians, 11, on the presidential denominational tally. However, if we are to be scrupulous, it is Calvin Coolidge, and only Calvin Coolidge, who among our nation's chief executives can be fairly described as having been a traditional Trinitarian Congregationalist his entire adult life. Religion was part of Coolidge's life from the beginning as he grew up among Baptists and Methodists and Congregationalists. His Coolidge forebears built the church in his hometown of Plymouth Notch, Vermont. His grandfather used the Gospel of John to teach young Calvin to read. His grandmother taught Sunday school. And before and perhaps after his mother's death, prayer sessions were held in the Coolidge home. Calvin began his education at a Baptist boarding school, then spent some time at St. Johnsbury Academy. And there he attended a service with the local Congos, as he described them. Yes, it seems he knew the in-house lingo. When it came time to attend college, he chose Amherst. And while the rationale for Amherst's founding no longer guided the school's academic mission and was but a part of its history at this point, it is worth noting that the place got its start as a theologically conservative Trinitarian congregational response to what were perceived as the dangerously liberal, and that is Unitarian, attitudes holding sway at Harvard. Western Massachusetts would prove to be formative in many parts of Coolidge's life. It was there he went to college, there he began the practice of law, there he embarked on his political career, and it was there he met his future wife, Grace, a member of the Edwards Church in Northampton. Now, it should be noted that it is difficult to find a church that was more congregationalist than Edwards, which was named after the seminal Puritan divine, Jonathan Edwards, who ministered to the people of Northampton while profoundly shaping the Protestant religion in America. Coolidge, however, did not join the church. Indeed, he did not join any church until he was president. But his reasons for not striking a formal affiliation are not one might guess. There were no reservations about the tenets of the church, no lingering questions about theology, no doubts about belief. Instead, Coolidge refrained from joining a church because he wasn't sure he was worthy. He didn't want to make a pledge to be part of a congregation, assuming what he believed were the responsibilities of living in a covenantal community, only to fall short of the mark. In short, he didn't want to be a hypocrite. So though he went to church regularly, he never actually joined. Then an interesting happened one Sunday in the nation's capital. The Coolidges began attending First Congregational Church in Washington, D.C. shortly after Calvin was sworn in as vice president. A little more than 2 years later, Warren Harding died and Calvin Coolidge found himself in the White House. On August 5th, 1923, Jason Noble Pierce, the minister, invited members and visitors who wished to do so to come forward to take communion. Now back then, people didn't enjoy the open table that we have now where anybody who wishes to participate can come forward. Back then, people were expected to be a member of the congregation, to be baptized, and to profess Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior. And it was in this context that the president and his wife presented themselves. Well, afterwards, Reverend Pierce asked the church to enroll the Coolidges as members, retroactive to the date they first took communion. And this request was unanimously accepted. In his autobiography, Coolidge noted his deep gratitude for the way he was brought into membership of the church. And being part of that church meant enough to the president that when his pastor, Dr. Pierce, was chairing the local arrangements committee of the meeting of the National Council of Congregational Churches that was being held in Washington, he agreed to serve as honorary moderator of the gathering. And each year that the Coolidges were in the White House, after the national Christmas tree was lit, an innovation during the Coolidge presidency, the choir of First Congregational Church was invited to sing carols for the community. Now, prior to the Civil War, Congregationalists, who were often associated with abolition, were a rarity in the Capitol. During the war, though, things changed as the city's population exploded. And among those who came to work in government and support the Union effort were many Congregationalists, and they needed a place to worship. That need was met in 1865 with the founding of the First Congregational Church. From its very beginning, the church was committed to welcoming all people, white or black, into membership. And when questions arose over the founding pastor's commitment to full integration of the congregation, he left. In the years to come, the church would take the lead in founding Howard University. This commitment to racial equality continued down through the years, and in 1925, in the midst of Coolidge's presidency, Marian Anderson was invited to give a concert at the church. Now, from today's vantage, none of this may seem significant, but consider the nature of Washington, indeed our nation, in the 1920s. Racism was omnipresent. Blacks were being lynched regularly. Overt segregation was the norm. And in the midst of all of this, President Calvin Coolidge chose to worship at a church that had, since its founding, been associated with full equality between the races. Perhaps this choice of faith community was driven solely by his desire to participate in a familiar form of worship. But if that was the case, there were other liturgically congenial and politically convenient options available. Yet Coolidge did not choose those options. Instead, though seeking no fanfare, he was making a statement, not through words, but through action. If what Paul taught, that in Jesus Christ there was neither Jew nor Greek, male nor female, free nor slave, was true, there was no reason the President of the United States should have any qualms about worshiping with and formally affiliating with a congregation that welcomed the descendants of slaves to become members. Coolidge wasn't one to speak of the needs of interest groups. He was concerned with the individual. And this approach can be problematic when one is part of a minority seeking redress. However, a letter of complaint afforded him the opportunity to make clear his attitude about racial issues during the 1924 campaign. A disgruntled voter was displeased that an African American was seeking a Republican nomination for a congressional race. And Coolidge replied, "I was amazed to receive such a letter. During the war, 500,000 colored men and boys were called up under the draft. Not one of them sought to evade it. A colored man is precisely as much entitled to submit his candidacy as anyone else." Coolidge made sure his response was publicized and carried in the press, and included it prominently in a later collection of his works. In the day when discrimination was rampant, Coolidge spoke out, perhaps not as we in the 21st century would have liked, but in a way that was striking for someone in his position at the time. It is hard, given where he chose to worship, to think that this action didn't stem from a worldview shaped by his faith. We know that faith sustained Coolidge after the death of his son Cal Jr. in 1924. And his faith may well have given Coolidge the humility to walk away from the presidency in 1928 rather than seek a second full term. Calvin Coolidge wasn't an ostentatiously religious man. He didn't give interviews promoting his faith. He didn't profess Christianity to earn votes. Instead, he lived a life of quiet, genuine faithfulness. And so on this Independence Day weekend, as we salute our nation's founding and honor our American story, let's also take a moment to appreciate Calvin Coolidge, congregation.